Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Do you feel alone? Struggling to find the work that you love and earn the fees that you deserve? Well, we can help. Entree Architect Academy is an educational program with monthly business training from top experts and a thriving community of passionate, supportive, small firm entrepreneur architects just like you. Enrollment is open. Come join us and build a better business. Visit entrearchitect.com for more information. You're listening to Entree Architect Podcast, episode 136. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. When did you discover architecture? At what age did you learn that architecture was something that you could do as a profession? When did you decide to become an architect? What inspired you? Why did you choose to become an architect? Those are questions that I ask every guest here at Entree Architect Podcast. I find the answers to these questions so inspirational and interesting. Were there places, were there people in your life that guided you or inspired you to make a difference through buildings? This week at Entree Architect Podcast, we dive deep into one entrepreneur architect's story. She shares her early influences, her inspirations, her passions, and her reconsideration of her entire life plan. This week, the journey to design the thrivable home with architect Stacia Hood. This episode of the Entree Architect Podcast is sponsored by FreshBooks, the easiest way to send invoices, manage expenses, and track your time. Learn more at freshbooks.com/architect. Stacia Hood, welcome to the Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you for having me here. Great to be here.
It's great having you here. You and I connected through the world of internet. Actually, the first place you introduced yourself to me was at our Entree Architect meetup in Philadelphia at the AIA convention. And you started talking about all the things that I love, sort of talking about all these different web personalities that we both follow. And it was a very interesting conversation. I'm like, this is somebody that I need to connect with. And we've connected with since then offline. Well, actually, it was online, but off public line. We talked a little bit about who you are and what you're doing. And I'm like, this has got to be somebody we have to get on the podcast because she has so much to share. So thank you very much for being here.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can I just say, I was so excited to meet somebody who was in this world of entrepreneurs and architects because I had been in this world and these circles of people, but really hadn't come across the architects that were in this world. So it was, that meetup was an exciting opportunity for me to connect with
people. It's a rare breed that when you say Jonathan Fields to an architect and you know who he is, it's like, yes, a kindred spirit.
Yay.
So if you don't know who Jonathan Fields is, go check him out. You should know who he is. He has a great, great platform. And maybe Stacia, sorry, will talk to us about that a little bit. Before we get into any of that, I'd love to start with your origin story. I want you to go back to where you discovered architecture, learned what that was, and what influenced you to become an architect, and give us that story of your journey to where you find yourself today.
My story. I'm one of those people that knew in the second grade that I wanted to be an architect.
That's an early one.
It was early.
That might be the earliest one yet.
I have books of playhouse designs that I would draw. And I used to invite kids in the neighborhood over to my house to design houses and playhouses. And a lot of times they would look at me sideways. But I spent my summers designing. And I was into gymnastics. I've always loved physics and I've always loved architecture. And so, you know, I drew some pretty elaborate playhouses in my early days. They all had elevators, dumbbell waiter style elevators that I would design and balance beams. And so I spent a lot of time doing that. And then in the fourth grade, we moved to a small village in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And I was born and raised in Oregon, so it was quite a culture shock. And I went to a school with 18 kids.
Wow.
The whole school. The whole school, kindergarten to eighth grade. And so there were three of us in the fourth grade, which was one of the largest grades in the entire school. And there were also two kids in this school who were in special ed. And one of these girls became my dear friend. She had physical and mental disabilities, but she taught me so much about the gift of laughter, being able to laugh at ourselves. And, you know, I spent a lot of time connecting with her in our own way. I don't think other people really understood our relationship, our friendship, but it had a profound impact on my life and the direction that I wanted to go. And, you know, she never used to play. She would stand by the teachers, you know, and I was the one that kind of nudged her along and, you know, would help hold her hands and we'd play two square with other people and we were a team and, you know, she would get laughing so hard she'd fall over. It was awesome. And, you know, one of my favorite memories was her mom let her come over to my house one day, which was huge. And I remember I had her on a sled and we'd spent the day playing on this golf course. You know, this is the White Mountains, New Hampshire. It's winter, snow. And then it was starting to get dark and I needed to get her home. And I put her in this sled. And as I would pull her, she would start laughing. And when she would laugh, she would turn into a noodle. And when she turned into a noodle, she fell out of the sled. And so I'm desperately trying to get her home before I get in trouble.
It's a
because
vicious cycle.
Yes. And as I was, you know, she would laugh more and she'd fall out. And it took forever to get her home. But it's one of my fondest memories of her and just, you know, recognizing that gift that when we laugh, you know, even though she was late, it was impossible to not laugh with her. And so as I went forward on this journey of exploring architecture and having this relationship, this connection with Betsy, that really influenced my path. I always knew I wanted to design or be connected with design that embraced all ages and all abilities. You know, at one point I thought, well, I'll design schools for kids with special needs, you know, because that was where it started for me.
Yeah.
And then it's evolved. You know, I went to architecture school at the University of Oregon, and it wasn't a huge piece of me then, but actually I should back up, because before I got into architecture school, I spent 2 years working as a substitute teacher in our local school district with special education. And so I spent time pushing wheelchairs. I spent time teaching kids how to navigate public transit. I spent time changing diapers. I spent time doing toilet transfers, you know, for middle school and high school kids. I spent time really understanding how people with, I hate the word disabilities, but with different abilities, unique abilities, interact with their world and the environment, and also how we interact with other people, interact with them. You know, when you're pushing a wheelchair through town, as the person pushing the wheelchair, I found that people don't look at the person in the wheelchair, nor do they look at the person pushing the wheelchair. And it can be incredibly isolating. And it's hard to feel connected when that's your experience. And so that experience taught me a lot. So, you know, when I got into architecture school, I had that awareness. You know, when you're designing where the elevator goes and where the top of the stairs land in a public building, you know, you think about people arriving at the same place. And so after architecture school, I worked for a small firm in Eugene. And that wasn't the right fit for me. It was commercial and hospital work. And we were so disconnected from, I felt really disconnected from the people that we were creating the buildings for. And I think really my dream had always been residential, but I kind of had this belief that you really can't make money as a residential architect.
Yeah.
You know,
very common belief. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that I had a class at the U of O that was a professional development class, and it was one of my favorite classes because it really taught you about how to become an architect. You know, once you get out of school, what do you have to do? What is this ARE and what are all the tests and how do you, you know, what does that path look like? And so during this class, one of the days the professor was out of town, and so we had to watch this movie. And this movie was on this firm in Minnesota, and the presenter was Sarah Susanka. And she talked all about the structure of this their firm and the fact that it was linear versus this hierarchy. And they talked about their marketing strategies and all these other pieces, and that they were actually successful as a residential firm. And to me, that was a huge, you know, we had to write a paper about this interview, and I remember just being incredibly excited about this new window that I was allowed to look through and see. And so I actually followed this firm for 2 years while I was working in Eugene and graduating from school. And I was reading everything that I could find about them, about their model and about how they were making it work. As, and not only work, but they were thriving as a residential firm. And so I found out that Sarah Susanka was going to be at a local Da Vinci Days event in Corvallis, Oregon. And I went. And I went with a friend who was an engineer in our firm. And we waited in line. We were last in line for the book signing after her talk. And I just said, you know, I love what you do and what you're doing. And, you know, I would love to find out more about Sala. I would love, you know, and she said, you need to contact Mulfinger. You know, this is, you know, at Sala, this is the path to Sala, basically. And so it took me a couple weeks to get up the courage to call Sala and to call Dale, you know, because that's who Sarah had told me to talk. And she actually had invited me to walk with her to her next event. And so we actually got to have this conversation and start, you know, that was my first introduction to her and to knowing her personally. And so it was exciting because I'd been following her for so long.
Just in case anybody doesn't know, I'm sure everybody who's listening knows, but Sarah is the author of the Not So Big House series.
Yes.
So that's what she's famous for, other than being a partner at Sala and doing this amazing architecture that she does. But she's globally known as the author of the Not So Big House series.
Yes. And at that point, she had just written the first one. And she, when I met her, I found out she had just left Sala. And so, and that was why she had suggested I contact Dale. So, you know, it's a couple of weeks later and I pick up the phone and my heart is racing. You know, I'm going to call Dale, you know, and it's, what do you say? You know, are you going to sound intelligent? You know, all of those worries, you know, this had been my dream for 2 years and a part of a much bigger dream. And I remember, like, the person, the receptionist answered, asked my name, you know, must have paged him and said, Stacia Hood or is on the phone. And he picked up the phone and he said, somebody sitting next to me wants to know why Stacia Hood is calling me or Stacia is calling me. And totally threw me. Like, it, that
you
was
had not, it all prepared.
Yeah,
you knew exactly what you're going to say. That wasn't part of it.
No. And so long story short, it turns out that one of the guys that had been in my terminal studio, my final studio at the U of O, was sitting next to him when I called. And so he already had some insight into who I was before he picked up the phone. And, you know, within a couple months, I was there for an interview. And within a month, I had moved everything to Minnesota with my golden retriever. I moved on 1/1/1, January 1st of 2001. I moved from Oregon to Minnesota by myself with my dog and landed in the frozen tundra. And they had just opened their Excelsior office. And I was one of, I don't know, it was five or six of us at the time. And I got to sit next to Dale Mulfinger. And that was an amazing opportunity. I got to sit next to this person that had created this firm. You know, Dale and Sarah had co-founded Sala together. And so I more than once would love to get Dale talking and to hear his stories.
Yeah.
And he loved to tell them.
Yeah, he's so, a great storyteller. I met him once at one of the AI conventions. He was giving a seminar and I attended it and then spoke to him afterwards. Very, very personable person, but a great storyteller.
Yes. And he loves, he's a mentor at heart and he loves to teach. And he loves to help people understand about architecture and what architects do. And, you know, Sala was really founded on this idea of educating the public and homeowners about what do architects do and how they can serve homeowners, you know, and the value that they bring to a project. And that was a critical part of working at Sala, was that outreach part in the community.
What were some of the things that they did in order to do that? Because that's a very common question at Entre Architect. That's something that architects struggle with all the time, is how do we communicate the value of architects to residential clients?
You know, I think Dale and, you know, when Sarah had been at the firm, had really kind of led that in their teaching classes at local art centers or community colleges, or, you know, through continuing ed programs, or, you know, Dale was just out there, and he was also, you know, Minnesota Public Radio, you know, he was on that show and his books and doing book tours. And Sala is a pretty prolific firm for publishers, authors.
Yeah.
You know, Sarah and her Not So Big House, but then Dale with his Cabin and the Getaway Home and Cabinology, and, you know, he's working on another one now. But they've just been out there, you know, interacting with the public and talking about architecture, you know, home and garden shows, doing presentations. And one of the ways that I was able to connect was I lived in a little town called St. Louis Park, which is a first ring suburb of Minneapolis. And St. Louis Park had a program called Move Up in the Park. And it was a fabulous program because the city actually paid for a 2-hour consultation with an architect. And as a way to get people within the community to invest in the infrastructure or the housing that they had in this first ring suburb. So I was given as the point person for that program. And so it got me out meeting with people and doing consultations and selling architecture, helping people understand that I had the solutions to their problems and that I could help them solve those challenges. So one of the things about working at Sala is that it was a huge firm recognized nationally. And so when projects came in with clients that were interested in accessibility, adaptability, universal design, it was known that that was an area of interest for me. And so I got a fair share of those types of projects handed to me with Dale. And so I actually, got to work on one project for clients that had severe chemical sensitivities and electromagnetic sensitivities. I did a home for some clients. Husband had muscular dystrophy and the wife had cancer, and a client whose son had muscular dystrophy. And so I got to recognize these clients and the needs that they were wanting. And a profound moment for me was a couple years ago, I went back and interviewed one of my clients. And it was the client who, they were in their 70s when I did the house. He had muscular dystrophy. She had had a cancer. And I went back to speak to them as the architect, post-occupancy. How does your house work? Yeah. How did we do? How is the roll-in shower? How do you like your elevator? How is the trench drain working in the shower? Those geeky architect pieces. And what was given to me at that experience was far beyond anything I imagined and has really shifted the trajectory of where I'm going now. Because what she gave me was the emotional pieces of what I had created and how it worked. And, she loved the architecture. She didn't want to talk about the architecture. We had created a space for caregivers. And they had a caregiver because she had had a botched radiation treatment, and it turned out that they were now both in wheelchairs. Her husband was now to the point where he was nonverbal in a power chair. And their goal, their dream was to stay in their homes because that's where their memories were and that's where they felt connected. And they lived on a lake, and he had been an avid fisherman. And so being connected to that lake was huge, even though he was nonverbal and in a power chair. That was his quality of life, was that connection. And so while I'm there, she asked to go speak in their bedroom away from where the caregiver was. And she started sharing the stories of the pieces that I hadn't known to help them understand that they were going to have to navigate. What is it like hiring and firing a caregiver? If you're a homeowner and want to stay in your home, are you going to be comfortable firing this person? Who gets to determine if you fire this person? What if one spouse loves the person and the other person doesn't? How do you navigate these decisions? And how do you, And so what is it like to have another person living in your home and taking care of your spouse of 50 years? Are you going to be comfortable with that decision? And these are all a piece of this decision to live in our homes and stay in our homes as we age. And she talked about how much she loved her home, but the fact that she felt completely trapped in her home. She wanted to go play bridge with her friends, but she couldn't get in their home because she couldn't get up the stairs to get in there. And all of her friends were 70 plus and weren't able to lift her up into their homes for bridge. She wanted to go to her sister's house for lunch, but she couldn't get in the front door. And so that's where I started recognizing that it isn't just about creating homes for ourselves that support us. We're all connected. We're all in relationship to other people. And so it's about creating homes that support and embrace all needs and all abilities, because we don't know, one, if something may happen to us, and we don't know if maybe a loved one is going to want to come over for Thanksgiving dinner and is going to be in a chair, and can they get into our homes to visit us and to be a part of the family? And so all of those pieces started, it really opened my eyes to the reality that it isn't just about creating homes for our clients that come to us, but I'm really on a mission to create the bridge that connects people to what this approach to design looks like and really why it matters to all of us, and not just the clients that show up asking for it, And so I've recognized that part of my job and part of where I'm going now is it's more about education and outreach. And this, you know, I call this approach to design thrivable design, thrivable, creating thrivable homes. And my goal is to help people understand why it matters to create homes that are adaptable and accessible and visitable and sustainable, so that they can be thrivable. And to me, that is being able to be supported in a way that we are each able to give our gifts to the world, whatever that unique thing is that's our individual superpower, our, you know, our own, yeah, our own gift.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to FreshBooks for their support as a platform sponsor of Entree Architect, because as a platform sponsor, FreshBooks has provided funding and support for our overall mission here at Entree Architect. They recognize the need for small firms like us to build better businesses in order to be better architects. FreshBooks is the easy-to-use accounting software designed to help us small firm owners get organized, save time, and get paid faster. It takes care of invoicing, expense tracking, estimating, reporting, and it all happens out on the cloud, so you have access to your information from anywhere that you have access to the internet. And I use FreshBooks for my own small firm, Five Cat Studio, and my favorite feature of the FreshBooks software is sending my invoices by email and allowing my clients to pay by credit card. When FreshBooks says that you'll get paid faster, they're not kidding. With the convenience of clicking a button and paying by credit card, many of my clients pay now as soon as they receive their invoice. And for those clients who don't pay right away, FreshBooks automatically sends them a reminder of the balance due at an interval that I set. So once I send an invoice, I can go back to being an architect, and I don't need to chase down any of my clients. And Tim Lee of FreshBooks will show you how easy it is to send invoices by email on our exclusive video series Tim and I produced exclusively for the Entree Architect community. Check out this free video series at entrearchitect.com/freshbooksvideo. There's no catch. There's no email. It's completely free. Just go to entrearchitect.com/freshbooksvideo and you will get the videos right away. There's three of them. Shows you everything you need to know about getting started. And then go to freshbooks.com/architect and sign up for your free 30-day trial and give it a try. It's free. I suggest you just send one invoice and see what happens. That's how I got started. Just send one invoice to one client and see how it works. And when I did that and I got paid much faster than usual, I signed up for the rest of it and I set up my whole account in FreshBooks. FreshBooks.com/architect for your free 30-day trial. And be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
So you're no longer at Sala.
I'm no longer at Sala.
And you mentioned Thrivable Home. So what happened there? You were inspired by that client. And what? Yes. How did you get to where you are now?
I left Sala after my son was born. And I stepped into the role of mom. And so I stepped away from architecture for 7 years, 8 years. And so part of where I've been the last few years is as a mom and as a female architect, how do I step back into architecture in a way that supports me as a mom and allows me to practice in a way that maybe I didn't recognize or see as an opportunity or even a possibility before? And so that's where I've been on this journey for the past 3-4 years. I ran into Sarah at the AIA convention in Denver, 2000.
Yeah, that was 3 years ago. Yeah, 2013. Yeah.
And I went to her with this idea that I was going to create an app. You know, I was going to connect the industry of universal design aging in place. And because one of the things I found, and also a piece of this, is I had an aunt who was diagnosed with ALS. And so I became aware of how does one navigate the industry when faced with a life-altering diagnosis. And at a time when you don't want to be remodeling your home. You want to be focused on taking care of, you know, yourself and living. That's when people are forced into this world that they're not familiar with. Contractors, builders, product manufacturers, wheelchair suppliers, you know, accessible vans. Like, it's overwhelming. And so I went to Denver with this idea that I was going to connect the industry and build an app and create something that people could navigate all of the players and have an understanding. And Sarah looked at me and she's like, yeah, you could do that, you know, or you could become the spokesperson for this type of design. And really, you know, I went to her with this idea of playing bigger than I ever had.
Yeah.
And she kind of like threw me up to the stars with this, you know, idea of where I could go. And at this point she said, you know, I know you could hold an audience. I know you could, you know, public speaking. I know you. And it was like, at this point, I've never stood in front of an audience and spoken. You know? And yeah. So I have since teased her that, you know, maybe she needs to write the book, The Not So Small Life, because what she proposed to me was anything but not so big. But I've spent the last few years getting comfortable with how do I as an architect practice in a way that doesn't look like a traditional architectural practice. And so that's where Jonathan Fields and all of these other people start to come into my world. I first attended a women's conference in Boulder, Colorado called Emerging Women. And it was all about feminine leadership, which as an architect, I was really good at playing the dude role, you know, because you fit into this role of the architectural industry is a male industry. And so this conference was a real eye-opener for me and the fact that I'd never really even heard the word feminine before and feminine leadership and really opened my eyes to the fact that when women lead from a place of authenticity, that's when we're most effective. And that means embracing emotions and feelings and all of these things that I had really not wanted to admit existed in my life for the majority
and,
of
and
my
you're
life.
trained as an architect to not go there. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're trained to be very technical and professional and to not go after the emotional part of things.
Yeah. And so where I'm going as an architect, you know, it's taken me a lot of time just to get comfortable with the fact that one, I'm a female architect, and two, like, I want to practice in a way that's non-traditional. And I want to talk about feelings and emotions and how our homes make us feel and give people permission to dream and to think about what it's like, and to recognize that if we build our dream homes and we haven't done the emotional work and we move into our dream homes, we're taking all that emotional clutter with us, and we're never going to learn how to just live and be and appreciate and enjoy that space that we created. So there are emotional and spiritual aspects to architecture that aren't a part of the traditional conversations. You know, we talk about how we feel when we walk into a big space and a small space, and, you know, that piece is there, but it isn't there for most homeowners. You know, that isn't something that they're taught. But I think as architects we are, but it doesn't really go outside architecture school and how we connect and talk about architecture with homeowners. And that's what I think people are craving. And so after Emerging Women, I then started hearing about different conferences and different events. And the next one I heard about was the World Domination Summit, which is in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
And
explain what that is, because that sounds like a very ominous.
Yeah. It's not the World Dominatrix. It's not, you know, it's about, I tell people it's all the good superheroes coming together that want to create positive change in the world. And so it's the dreamers that all from around the world that all come together in one place. And, you know, one of the things that Chris Guillebeau, who's the founder of WDS, World Domination Summit, says is, you know, the first year I was there, he got on stage and the first thing he said was, how do we live a remarkable life in a conventional world? And it was at this event that I met, you know, Chris Ducker, and I started connecting with this idea of blogging and podcasting and, you know, ways that I could reach people outside the traditional ways that architects have. You know, that there's this world of entrepreneurship and people are doing things in really unique ways and they're making money doing it. And so I went thinking that there's like a path, like you just had to figure out where do you get on the path.
Right. Give me the book. Give me the guide.
Give me the book and you do this, you do this, you do this, and then you make money and then you do this. And there is no book. And it's really about connecting to yourself, connecting to your passion, connecting to what's really important to you. And then what do people that you, what do the people who you want to serve need? And creating that bridge and connecting it. And so at this event, again, I met Jonathan Fields and I got to talk to him briefly. And at this point, I'm looking for people to help me build my app. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you could create it and you could create this app. You could create this really successful business. But what if you find out you don't like the people, you know, that you're serving? What if you find out that, you know, where you get isn't actually where you wanted to go? And I kind of say he picked me up and pulled me back and kind of dropped me. And he was so right, is you have to really, because at this point with this app idea, I didn't have that awareness of who are the people I want to serve and what do they need. And it's crucial to have that understanding of who is your client. And it's something that Sala did really well. You know, they knew their clients and they knew their clients' needs. And one funny story from Sala. When Sarah and Dale first started Sala, they started going to Home and Garden shows and setting up their booth. And they were one of the first firms to do this. And somebody came by and said, you know, so what are you giving away? And they didn't have anything, you know. And so this guy gave them some advice. Well, you know, you do a drawing and then everybody wins, you know. And you, so they did this. And I don't remember the number, but I want to say it was like 200 people put their information into their, you know, box. And it took them months and months to go through and do these two-hour consultations that everybody had won. But what happened is they actually got to really know and talk to and have conversations with these people that they wanted to serve. And they planted more seeds than I think they could ever understand in every one of those conversations. Because they, maybe one of the people they talked to didn't actually do a project, but maybe one of their friends called them and said, hey, we want to do this project. Do you know an architect? Or what should we do? You know, and then they can say, hey, I just had this architect that came and talked to me a year ago. You know, they were great. I think you should. And so one thing Sala taught me is that every conversation we have plants a seed. You know, it's, you never know what's going to come from and result from these, you know, as we share our ideas.
So where was the shift from the app to not that, the app? Because you actually, which is very interesting, because you talked about how Jonathan said, well, what if you get there and it's not where you want to be? That happened to you at Sala, right? You dreamed of going to Sala. You went there, you worked there, you loved it. And then you decided you're going to leave. How did that comment from Jonathan affect your decision going forward with the idea of the app?
It really got me to start questioning. I can be a bit over-focused at times. You know, it's like I decided in the second grade I was going to become an architect.
Right. And I think the blinders went on, right?
The blinders went on.
I had the same experience.
And I think architecture is a part of what I'm doing, but I don't think it's So even when I worked at Solo, which was one of my dream jobs, you know, like working at Solo was the end, you know, of where I thought I needed to go. And I got there and I loved it. And I loved sitting next to Dale and asking him questions and picking his brain and the conversations. I mean, that was awesome and amazing. And the clients were incredible. And working at Sala, I worked directly with clients. You know, Dale wasn't involved in the project, but I was given a lot of responsibility and learned a lot because of that. You know, I would at one point was working on 8 projects at a time. You know, that's, and I had students working under me. And so, but it wasn't where I came alive. Sitting at my drafting board drawing or at my computer was kind of torture for me, because I am very much an introvert, and maybe actually more an ambivert, because I also need to be able to have conversations and to move and to walk around. And so sitting was not my strength. I loved going out and talking to clients, and I loved selling architecture, and I loved that more active part of architecture. And so actually, while I was working at Sala, I was also working as a server in a restaurant, a Mexican restaurant, because that gave me that ability to move and to talk to people that I also needed. And so taking the blinders off, you know, I forced myself into this place of discomfort. What am I doing? Where am I going? What does this look like? And I don't have the answers, because what I'm creating doesn't exist.
And you've spent your entire life to become an architect. Since you were in second grade,
yes,
you were an architect. And you were an architect all those years, to the point where you worked everything, all your goals, all your focus was on becoming an architect. You became the architect, and now you are where you are.
And yeah.
And now you're looking bigger. You're looking beyond being an architect. Architecture is part of it, but yeah, it's not your purpose.
No. And so this is where, you know, I've just been on this journey of meeting these amazing, inspiring people. And so at this event that I got to talk to Jonathan, I found out that he was going to be running this summer camp. And in my head, it was like, I have to go to summer camp. Like, I want to go to this event. It was an entrepreneurial camp, and it was workshops about business and how to create an Instagram following and how to do all these different things. You know, there are all these different workshops. And it was Jonathan Fields, a Good Life Project. And, you know, it was a hell yes inside of me. And yet as a mom, you know, it was, how in the hell do I take more time to go to summer camp?
Right.
And a couple of weeks later, I was in the car and my son was in the back seat, who at the time was, I don't know, 6 or 7. And his friend was sitting next to him and they were talking. And my son said, you know, when you get to be about 16 or 17 or 18, you have to quit playing and you have to find a job and you have to start working. And that to me was a, oh, hell no moment. No. And it was that realization of, I have to go to summer camp because I have to teach my kids that we have to continue to play and we have to continue to embrace our curiosity. And so I signed up for camp. And when I got to camp, there was a talent show. And I just kind of knew I had to get on stage and talk, because what other opportunity is given to you like that for public speaking? And I remember I went up to the woman who was taking information about people that wanted to be on the talent show. And I said, I'm going to talk about my hidden talent of public speaking. I had no clue what I was going to talk about. And I don't have some hidden talent of public speaking. And she looked at me kind of sideways, like, what in the hell are you talking about? But she wrote my name down. And then there was a woman at camp, Marcia Shandor, who had offered to help coach me on a talk. And she and I spent the day talking about this story of me as a gymnast. And it just wasn't landing with me of what I needed to really say. And so the morning of the talent show, I woke up and I still didn't know what I was going to talk about on stage in front of 300 people who I highly admired. You know, John Lee Dumas was in the audience. Scott Dinsmore, Jonathan Fields, like these are people that I had looked up to were going to be sitting there and listening to me. And I didn't know what I was going to talk about. And then the story of my clients from Minnesota came to me. And that story of having gone and visited them and the lessons they gave me. And I wrote down some ideas and what I was going to talk to and some framework of just some basic bullet points of their story. And I called a friend and I went into the woods. It was raining. And I just started talking through this speech. And I skipped the evening sessions. And, you know, before the talent show, Marcia and I stood outside and did the Amy Cuddy power poses. And, you know, when I was still standing as the next person to go up in this talent show, I still really didn't know what I was going to say. And I remember the woman standing next to me, Shelley, looked at me and she's like, "You're not breathing." So, you know, I got up on stage and I have to say, like, I'm thinking camp talent show, this is going to be some hokey fun, you know. And all I can say is I would have paid to have seen the seven acts that were before me. And the evening ended out with, I mean, the amount of talent that was at this camp was unbelievable and mind-blowing. But I got on stage and I did it, and I told my story. And that was a huge hurdle for me because I had this story of, I don't know how to be a public speaker. I've never done it before. And so I got home from camp, and the next day I found out that I had met all the certifications to become a certified aging in place specialist through the National Association of Home Builders, that I had met all the requirements. And then I looked it up and I realized that I'm the first architect in the state of Oregon with that certification at the time. And that was a really exciting, special moment for me. And then the next day I got a phone call from a woman that I had spoken with at a bike race that wanted to know if I was still doing this type of architecture about people in their homes and aging. And I said, yes. And she said, well, I work for the local hospital and we have a fall prevention event coming up and we'd like you to come and be a presenter. And I can tell you that had I not gone to camp and had I not gotten up on stage and had I not had the certification that came through that said I was qualified, I would have said no. But all of those things aligning, it was a hell yes.
Yeah.
And so I went to this event and I showed up. I talked to people. And I left thinking, I don't know that anything's going to come of this, but we'll see. And I got an email the next day from a woman I had spoken to who was a part of a group of women in Eugene called the Fairy Godmothers. And I had had a conversation with her about a vision boarding workshop I had taken at camp. And she said, you know, I think you have something to teach us, this group. And I'd like to know more about this type of architecture that you do. And I'd also like to do, you know, something with vision boarding. And that was where I started to realize that she gave me what I had been trying to work towards and what am I creating? I want to talk about and teach people about this type of architecture, and I didn't know the format to do it in. And so I actually created this workshop for them that was all about what does this type of design look like? How do we create beautiful homes that support people through all stages of life? How do we continue to dream? And I showed them images of, you know, what does this type of design look like? And we talked about grab bars and, you know, I really want to make grab bars sexy and desirable, you know, and shift how people see them and push the envelope on all of these parts of thrivable design, creating a thrivable home. But when I got done with teaching them, then I led them through a vision boarding workshop, which was really, I instructed them to create these boards that I gave them architectural magazines and yoga magazines and asked them to focus on how they wanted to feel in their homes and what were images that they thought were beautiful and that they could dream. And it gave them a tangible place to put their dreams. And the boards they created blew me away. They were beautiful. And as an architect, I realized if a client brought a board like that to me, there was so much information on those boards that I think we as architects already resonate with and understand. I realized it was a powerful tool. And so as I'm going forward now, where I'm focusing is creating, I'm calling it a living document. And I'm still in the process of creating it. But it's design questionnaires. It's stories of me as an architect and the clients I've worked with. It's images of what this can look like. It's vision boarding exercises on how to create a vision board and giving people a place to dream. And it's talking about why it's important to keep dreaming.
And you're creating this platform, right? This is
yep.
The Thrivable Home is your platform. That's where you're going. That's where you go now to learn about this thrivable design. It's essentially universal design for the masses, right? I mean, it's the intent is to bring universal design to everyday design. Much like architects now design sustainably. That years ago, 15, 20 years ago, sustainable design was its own thing. And you sort of plugged it in and applied it as necessary. Some clients wanted it and you would, plug in the sustainable design into your architecture. But today, architects really design every design with sustainability, or most do anyway, with the intent of making it a sustainable project. That's how we do it. We no longer look at ourselves as a sustainable architect or trying to plug in these pieces. We just design it that way. It's just good design. And I think we look at your projects and your platform the same way, that every project should be designed universally. Every project should be designed in a way that everybody can use it. The Thrivable Home is the place where you're going to spread the word about this, both to architects and to the global population of humanity who need to know these things. It's a great place to be.
Yeah. I also think that the industry is a little bit upside down and backwards with this idea of like aging in place. I really believe that when we design well for a 5-year-old, it'll work for a 105-year-old or an 85-year-old. And so what I've found too is that when we shift this idea of creating homes that support 5-year-olds or 2-year-olds or pushing strollers, or we then create these homes that support whole life design, and it's a much bigger platform, and it shifts the energy to something that's much more playful versus something that feels fear-based of you don't want to fall. And so that's kind of where I'm going with Thrivable Home now too, is embracing that playful part of what this approach to design can look like and helping people understand what it looks like and how to implement it in your home. Even if you're just buying a refrigerator, what do you think about French doors with the freezer on the bottom? It's much easier for a kid to open. It's much easier for an elderly person to open. It's much easier for somebody in a chair to open, And so it's starting to talk about these tangible little things that people can do, even if they don't want to remodel their entire home, to start to implement the ideas of creating a thrivable home. And I really want to create the market for architects, my goal isn't sitting down as an architect and drawing. It's creating clients for other architects.
Yeah, you've been on a long journey, and
yes.
And it sounds like you're really just at the beginning.
Yes,
I'm just
getting started.
Yeah. I mean, you just told us your whole origin story. It's as expected. It was the entire episode.
Yeah,
it is a great story, but it's really just the beginning. The beginning of Thrivable Home and where it's going to go. So I highly recommend that listeners go to thrivablehome.com. That's right?
Yep.
Thrivablehome.com and go check out what you're doing. Learn what you have to offer. Stacia, thank you very much for your service to this profession and what you're doing, spreading the word about what you're doing and being an inspiration to others for doing that.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being here. Like I said, your corner of the internet is thrivablehome.com. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you our one final question. what is the one thing that small firm architects can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
The one thing that I've learned from my experience is to just start talking to people, telling your stories, talking about where your passion lies, talking about what you're curious about, and following your curiosity. You know, it starts with a conversation.
You may be surprised at where it leads.
Yes, because other people will start to give you pieces of the puzzle are all along the journey.
Totally agree. I mean, the only way Entree Architect has grown into what it is today is through those connections, that, you know, reaching out and meeting people and talking about my passion. That's how we've grown, and you're doing the same thing. That's great advice to know what your passion is, you know, try to figure that out. That's not an easy thing to do. I mean, it took you your whole life to get to this point.
Yeah.
But you've discovered this. This is your purpose, you know, and the same thing happened with me with Entree Architect. This is my purpose. I'm still an architect. I love architecture. I had the blinders on. I became an architect because I had those blinders on, but I would never regret it. I love it, but it brought me to where I am today, helping other people be more successful and happier. And you're doing the same thing. So thank you very much for sharing your knowledge here at Entree Architect Podcast. And I can't wait to see the next chapter of your journey.
Thank you for having me.
Complete show notes and a direct link to download this episode will be found at entrearchitect.com/episode136. So what's your story? What's your plan? Is your career as an architect working out the way you had dreamed? If not, I suspect it may be your struggle with business. I know because I work with and I speak to hundreds of architects just like you every year. That's why we created Entree Architect Academy. It's an educational program with monthly business training from top experts teaching us what we need to know to live that life we've dreamed. It's a thriving community of passionate, supportive, small firm entrepreneur architects just like you. I want you to succeed and live that life of your dreams. Enrollment for Entree Architect Academy is now open. Come join us and build a better business. Visit entrearchitect.com for more information. It's all right there on the homepage, entrearchitect.com. My name is Mark Arlepage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. I encourage you to find the work that you want and live that life you'll love. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening this week. Have a great one.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gehry. Visit glengehry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.